The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
So we continue with our practice and study of the Lojong teachings, which are Tibetan teachings that have proved very useful to Buddhist traditions generally, and they've been adapted for Zen by Norman Fisher. And today, this morning, I wanted to look at the very last one in point two, the first point two, training in empathy and compassion, absolute compassion. So this is number six. In post-meditation, be a child of illusion. And I first want to say that this phrase initially, when I was reading through the 59 slogans, this phrase initially had a kind of koan-like effect on me. In post-meditation, be a child of illusion. Because my first response was, why would I want to be a child of illusion? That just sounds wrong. As many koans, that sound just wrong at first. And we say, when we take our bodhisattva vows together each day, more than once, we say, delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. And it sounds a little bit like, well, so surely we're not now asking to be children of delusion. And is delusion different from illusion? So I've been working with this, and I would like to share with you where I am now. And then in our Dharma dialogue, perhaps we'll all get a bit further together with this wonderful teaching. So, I want to break the phrase down as I discuss it. And so, I'll say the whole phrase one more time, and then we'll look at parts of it, and then come back to the whole. In post-meditation, be a child of illusion. And so let me start where Norm Fisher starts with the notion of post-meditation. And that's a term that we don't hear very much, but I've really come to appreciate it. Post-meditation, we talk a lot about meditation or zazen, but not so much explicitly about post-meditation, which is a little bit different than everything other than zazen. I've been sitting at Shuso, where Joanne is sitting now, facing the open door for several days. And part of my job as Shuso is to make sure that people that come in know where they are and know what we're doing and can be assisted if they need assistance and be welcomed if they need welcoming. And so sitting across from this open door at this open house sesshin has been a great privilege. And I felt that there was something about the big open Zendo door that really has for me been embodying the spirit of our retreat. And in addition, with this slogan and this notion of post-meditation, it's also been appearing to me as a threshold, because the doorway is always a threshold. And this slogan in post-meditation, be a child of illusion, forms the threshold between the two point twos, between absolute compassion and relative compassion. And so in post-meditation itself is a threshold moment. So this is the moment when we move out of zazen, when we move out of meditation. Post can mean simply after. So when we say it's 1 p.m., the P is post-meridian. It's after noon, after the middle of the day. And it's just after. Morning's done. That happened. Now it's afternoon. It's post-meridian. But post, much more often, post not only means after, but it means after and very different because of what went before. And so maybe like I did, a year or two ago, you've gotten a sheet from your doctor that said post-surgery instructions. And post-surgery doesn't unfortunately mean, well, that's over, and I can move on to the next thing. I can hop on my bike and go to the beach for that beach volleyball game I do every Sunday. That's not at all what it means. Post-surgery means the surgery is over. And now things are really going to be different for a short while or a long while because of it. And you have to do all kinds of special things to take care of yourself. And many post words, I don't want to go through too much of this, but choose your own favorite. But, you know, post-industrial, postpartum, many post words mean not just after, but really different because of what went before. And this is how we are encouraged to think of post-meditation. It's not just that meditation is over and now we're going to do something else. Now, this one's tricky because we can have that attitude. And so, to a degree, this is up to us. We could have the attitude maybe in our daily practice at home. All right, now I did my meditation. Now I did my zazen. And I can have breakfast. We're encouraged by our own training in Zen and by this Lojong training not to do that, but to take the attitude that we're going to take something with our meditation with us into whatever we do next, whether that's doing kinhin or whether that's going into the kitchen to help the tenzo or whether that's going out the door into what we think of as the world outside. So this threshold state, it's sometimes said that to emphasize this, that the most important moment in zazen is the moment you get up from the cushion. Because that's going to determine what your post-meditation is. So post-meditation is where we start in this phrase, and then we go to be a child of illusion. The trickiest part of it, maybe, for me at least, to understand at first. And so Norman Fisher picks up on the notion of being a child and talks about it in some ways that we've been talking about it here at this retreat in the Dharma talks and Dharma dialogues, that there is something to be said for an attitude of childlike wonder and awe. And I just refer you to that discussion because the Tibetan commentators go someplace else. And it's a place that right now I'm finding more interesting. So let me just start by reading to you what Chögyam Trungpa, in his book Training the Mind and Cultivating Loving Kindness, says at the beginning of his discussion of in post-meditation, be a child of illusion. Here's how Trungpa Rinpoche starts. Being a child of illusion means that in the post-meditation experience, there is a sense that everything is based on creating one's basic perceptions out of one's preconceptions. So you can see how this circles back to the first of the slogans in the Absolute Compassion section, which is all dharmas are dreams. Being conscious of the fact that you are partly creating everything you perceive and that your ideas and your categories and your stories and as Trungpa says, your preconceptions are modifying everything that comes to you. And sitting in meditation has helped you become more aware of this as you go through some of the other skills that have been, skills really we could call them, or practices that have been evoked earlier in this section on absolute compassion regarding all dharmas as dreams, analyzing the mind, and then the last one that we didn't talk about, which is translated into Zen as rest in the openness of mind. And we had a wonderful exposition of that in the sutra service in Hongzhe's Guideposts on Silent Illumination. what it means to rest in the openness of mind during our Zazen practice. Let me just read you the first three lines of that to remind you. Silent and serene, forgetting words, bright clarity appears before you. When you reflect it, you become vast. Where you embody it, you are spiritually uplifted. So this is that experience of the openness of mind that we can and sometimes do have on the cushion. And this helps us to understand as we get off the cushion that all dharmas are dreams. So back to Trungpa. I'll start this paragraph over again. It's pretty short. Being a child of illusion means that in the post-meditation experience, there is a sense that everything is based on creating one's basic perceptions out of one's preconceptions. If you can cut through that and inject some basic understanding or awareness, you begin to see that the games going on are not even big games, but simply illusory ones. To realize that requires a lot of mindfulness and awareness working together. Here we are talking about meditation in action, actually, or post-meditation discipline. So, being a child of illusion, in this sense, I've been thinking, it's like when someone says to you, don't forget where you came from. You know, don't forget who your parents are. You're a child of illusion. Don't forget what your meditation experience has taught you. Don't forget that your mind is prone to creating illusory versions of everything you encounter. So not at all be a child of illusion, as in be a child playing in the funhouse of illusions, not to indulge in them. But don't forget that this is where you're coming from. And let your meditation experience, let your Zazen, keep that alive for you as you go into the world. Trungpa's student, Pema Chodron, who became such a great teacher in her own right, has a kind of distillation of this same idea, so I'll read you her brief commentary on this slogan. When you finish sitting meditation, if things become heavy and solid, if your illusory version of the world starts to seem too real, if things become heavy and solid, be fully present and realize that everything is actually pliable, open, and workable. This is instruction for meditation in action, realizing that you don't have to feel claustrophobic because there's always lots of room, lots of space. So what she adds is that you take that spaciousness that you can experience in Zazen, that Hangzhe calls silent illumination, and bring it with you into your experience of the world, so you're simultaneously aware of how much you are constructing what you see as the child of illusion that you are. And at the same time, you're not troubled so much by all the dharmas that are coming at you, all of the things that you're getting hit with as you move into the world, because you can also maintain that sense of spaciousness as you encounter your life. And after all, this is what we're talking about these 3 weeks, is how we live our lives. And in this case, how Zazen can help us to live our lives, can guide us in living our lives. So I've been thinking about, to make this real for me in my life, I've been thinking about ways that I am a child of illusion. And I thought I'd share some of those with you, and then you can share some of your experiences with me in the Dharma Dialogue. And one way I've realized that I've become over my years of doing Zazen a child of illusion is that instead of being troubled by all the little visual and auditory and conceptual illusions that come up for me in the course of just any given day, I don't think more than anyone else. I used to be bothered by them, and now I'm just kind of amused by them, and I like them because they remind me that everything that I'm experiencing has a certain contour of allusion to it. That not that I'm living in a hallucinatory matrix-like projection, but that I'm encountering real things, but I'm putting my spin on everything. It's getting processed by my brain before it ever gets into my mind, if you can buy that distinction. And it's being mediated through my senses before it gets to my brain, right? We're suddenly going through the Heart Sutra again. Sensation, perception, mental reaction, consciousness. Every stage has its own layering. And so, as a child of illusion, when this is brought out for me vividly, for example, we had a beautiful example of walking in the forest in the Dharma Dog dialogue yesterday when Jenny talked about her forest practice. And so I was reminded that when I walk in the woods, Jenny and I are both Appalachian trail hikers, and so we're sometimes walking in the woods for days on end. And when I walk in the woods alone for a day or two or a week, sometimes I get these very vivid illusions. I'll see the wall of a white house coming up in front of me on the trail, up a ways on the trail, right in the middle of woods that only have this trail going through it. And I'll think, oh, house! But, wow! And then I get closer, and it's the sun shining brightly on some yellow poplar leaves, because there's a little stand of poplar trees. And this wall, this white wall that looks so solid, suddenly resolves into these shimmering leaves. Or I'll hear a girl singing on the trail in front of me, thinking I'm alone in the woods. Maybe it's November and nobody's out there but me. I hear this beautiful singing voice, and I turn the corner, and there's no girl, but there's this quickly running stream, and it's musically running over the stones in the stream. Or I hear a droning man's voice in the summer, and then right down the trail towards me comes a huge bumblebee. And so these don't trouble me, but they remind me that all the other things that the trees and the stones and the rivers I have to cross, that still are trees and stones and rivers when I meet them, aren't quite the trees and stones and rivers that they are to somebody else, or that they are to the bird that's flying over them that sees them in a very different way, or that they might be to me the next day when I'm in a different mood. So I walk the trail as a child of illusion. And in my dealings with other people, I've learned to be a child of illusion, because I've learned through my Zen practice, including the living part of it, my life part of my Zen practice, that I really don't know what other people are about and what they're thinking and what they're going through and where they just were. Even people I think I know very well, like my own siblings or the person I love. I've made a conscious decision to let these people remain mysteries to me. One time we were having a Dharma dialogue at our Hank Sangha in Newton, and we were talking about intimacy. And Bob Waldinger, sensei now, said something amazing about a study that had been done in psychiatry, where they were doing a study, scientifically controlled study of how well people listen to each other with couples. And it turned out, this is quite interesting, that the couples that had only been together a year or two, less than 2 years, did way better at listening to each other than the couples that had been together for 30 years. Now, you'd think those would be the couples that really know each other. But it turns out that it's not. Those are the couples that think they know all about the other. And the new couples are still aware that they're figuring each other out. They don't know. There's lots of stuff they don't know. And so I made a kind of vow that I would never think that I knew really knew anybody in the sense of, yeah, now I know what you're really saying. I know what you're thinking. I know how you are. I know what you do. That I just would stop doing that forever. And so I try. So that's and it's because I know that when I look at even people I know intimately, I'm still a child of illusion. I'm seeing them through my idea about who they are. And that idea gets stronger and harder with the years if we let it. Or we can keep it spacious. We can keep it, as Pema Chodron says, pliable. And so this is part of my life practice now. And then finally, I'll just give one more example. I have, in the way I look at myself, I have tried to live as a child of illusion. Because a huge part of my practice over the last 3 years or so has been to realize how much I don't know myself. And this too is something that's now well known in interpersonal psychology. There are studies that show that I just said that we don't really know anybody else, but it turns out that your friends know you better than you know yourself in many ways. And there are these great studies that show that. Because, let's face it, we're all stuck on these ideas about who we are that are curiously close to our ideas about who we want to be and who we should be. And we are able to delude ourselves a lot of the time into thinking that that's who we are. Yeah, that's right. Even when we do these egregious things that should embarrass the hell out of us and give us a little wake-up call, we have this ability to say, yeah, but that's not really me. I had a little too much wine to drink, or the kids had been screaming and I was really irritated, or... yeah, I had a bad day at work and I'm sorry I brought it home with me. That wasn't really me. No, that was really you. That was you. You're the one that did that awful thing that you would like to think didn't really happen because it wasn't really you. And so I've been working in my life practice with getting away from certain very fixed ideas I had about myself, like, oh, I'm a nice guy. Well, not all the time, and not in any simple way. And I'm a tough guy, a hard guy. You know, no. I have such weaknesses that I become more aware of as I age, but that I've always had. And you know, I could go through the list. I'm pretty easygoing. Well, yeah, on a good day. In a good hour. And so in relation to the world as we encounter it, the 10,000 things, the myriad dharmas, in relation to these amazing constellations of dharmas that we call other people, that we encounter in relation to ourselves, we can be children of illusion. And this is something that we cultivate every time that we sit on the cushion in that spirit of openness and allow that spaciousness that Hongzhi speaks about so beautifully in his poem to arise. And this is something that we can take from the cushion and bring into our lives. So, in post-meditation, be a child of illusion. So please feel free to move your legs and sit more comfortably. And we will now have a Dharma dialogue. A reminder that our Dharma talks here are being recorded, and the recording can be stopped at any time if that would make you more comfortable.
We'll say our names.
Oh, yes. And first we'll go around and say our names. Alan.
Camden.
Jenny.
Ray.
Craig.
Susan.
Paul.
Fabian.
I'm Joanne.
Debbie.
David.
Melissa.
Alan, when you were talking and talking about how your perception of yourself is quite different, and then you followed it by saying, and that's been quite well known to everyone. But that's it about the all of our inaccuracies. But I thought there'd been this conference about Alan that I wasn't invited to. But of course, it's quite true for all of us. We think we're quite showing one thing and quite clear, and certainly no one knows. And I think all of us actually are quite much more transparent than we believe. Mm. Like we're all revealing the many, the fullness of it, not the limit itself, whatever. Good. Some of us have a bad limited self that we really believe in our brokenness. So not just I believe I'm the nice one, but oh, I believe I'm the one who's especially broken. And then we hold on to that in the same way. It's quite amazing. It doesn't seem to matter whether it's aggrandizing or diminishing. It's solidifying the ego. And I love this pliability, the kind of breathing life into that that you're talking about so beautifully.
Right, because it's so easy to get into rigidity about who we are, whether we're, you know, whatever it is, negative, positive, it's such an ever-changing thing. But then we don't want to get caught in the it's an ever-changing thing and I don't have any habits. You know, so you can... I love the image of the white wall because, you know, I mean, I've never seen that particular one, but we really believe that we're seeing something about ourselves or about others, and we get closer and everything fractals into its essence nature. And then we, you know, it's a kind of shocking moment. Mm. But then it coheres back again. And it just keeps doing that, you know. So this is the form and emptiness thing around the self that I think you were also pointing to. Thank you.
Kevin.
Yeah, thank you for your talk. That was awesome. I had something. Yeah, a few things came up. I really loved Pema Chodron's space, and I loved Chogyam's. We make like a big deal out of like, or like a big game out of like these small illusions or something. And for me, just noticing how tightly I can contract around those patterns, around those places that I go. And, you know, how when I'm especially out of practice, those places feel really intense in my gut. Mm. Like it's like a in my abdomen. But when practice is there, you know, like David was saying, like the breathing space, like there's almost like an aura of room around that. So it's not so much certainty around that movement. You know, not that the movement changes, but that just the holding of it is different. And, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And you really, you know, I love the way that you brought that into the fact that even our bodies seem way more solid to us than they are, you know, and there's actually this, you know, huge canal going from the lungs through the thorax and there is this openness that we can physically feel, and I agree with you that zazen, you know, helps us be more aware of that. And so even these things we call gut feelings or a tightness in the gut, you know, even in a very literal bodily way, we can put space around them, actual feel the actual air or space around them. Yeah, thank you, Kevin. Paul.
I appreciated the time on post. You know, because in that phrase, it does bother me a little bit, this post-meditation. Mm. And I have to admit that I kind of quickly dismiss that. Well, this is Zen. And, you know, everything is Zazen. So, you know, to kind of grab on to this absolute absolute, you know, quality as far as to it. I can also live in that very relative world that, okay, I need to meditate between 7 and 7:30. Okay, 7:30, check, it's done. Now I need to get in the car. You know, I mean, I can really be there as well. And so I appreciated the way you brought this forward in this, you know, this kind of declarative, you know, things have changed. You know, that this, you know, that, you know, kind of going forward, it's an acknowledgement of that meditation time, and it's the reality of moving past that set time, but bringing it forward. I hadn't looked at it in that way. I think I was so quick to dismiss it as one, or the reality of my life as the other, in this aspect of, this kind of line that's drawn in, but it's a line in the sand, right? and stepping over it in that way. So I appreciated that, and all the other elements of your talk is just truly lovely. I did appreciate the bumblebee. I think I was talking about the wall. I've heard that bumblebee, and then I realized it's not a bumblebee. It's me. You know, it's that old man. You know,
where is the old man?
There it is. Just yesterday, I was trudging to the snow. Still that bumblebee.
Thank you, Paul. And this is one of those many areas where, yes, it's both.
Yeah.
Yes, you know, this is Zen, and so, you know, Zazen isn't just contained to a 25-minute period on the cushion. You know, we're always doing Zazen. And yes, there is a difference between sitting on the cushion and getting up and that post-Zazen, post-meditation transition is an important one. So, yeah. So thank you for reminding us of the other side. And as always, you know, our task is then to keep them both in mind simultaneously.
And I also see this particular slogan as a warning about, directed to us as Zen practitioners, you know, and I think you're both pointing that out, because we have so much clarity arise, right, in Zazen, official, formal, sitting upright in the middle of it all. And then, can lose that. I think there's a kind of warning. Be a child of illusion. Remember that you've got to keep this going through anything that doesn't look like formal practice. So we tend to say in Zen, everything is Zazen. And the other side is also true, and watch out. It's really dangerous waters, because we can get caught in our opinions and judgments and forget that we need to be children of illusion in that moment.
Yeah. And of course we will get caught.
And we will get caught.
Of course we're going to get caught.
Right, over and over again.
Craig.
I appreciate that. That phrase was impenetrable to me, and a little less so now. Thanks. And I was, as you talked, I was noticing that the reflection of the windows all come pointing to me. And then I realized that they all probably pointed to me. And talking about being a child of illusion makes me think that I can see through that illusion if I study it. You know, I think I'm through that. But there's a lot of other illusions, like that I'm sitting here as an independent entity, is a little harder.
Yeah.
So you're telling me to think that I should use these illusions that are more transparent as pointers to remind me that there's many more that are more inscrutable.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Craig. Beautifully said.
Well, and really this is... I was just talking to somebody earlier today about this very thing, that we think that at some point we're going to see through all the illusions, right? And it appears to me, living a life in Zen, that this practice never ends. That's why we call it practice. We're continually practicing on this very point. But really, you know, I have that with the moon. The moon is always coming to me, you know, right? It's the same kind of illusion. And it seems so true. It really seems true. And then to constantly be suspicious of any chain of narrative that we're working with, positive or negative, you know, or neutral. It doesn't matter what it is. I got it. That's it. Now I can go to the movies. But even at the movies, realizing, I love the movies, in fact, if you really are seeing a movie film go through a projector, that's just little pieces of pictures, but it really appears to be real. You know, that people are moving and they're talking, but if you look, they're not. And so it's just constant work until the very last breath to not be caught by these by delusive certainty.
Ray?
The piece, I like this discussion very much, I don't think about, you know, like, we started off by saying our names, and it's like, Ray. Oh, that's a few questions. I said I was Ray, but
I'm not sure.
And I can live that way. I think where I get stuck is when I get reactive. You know, I feel a constriction, a tightness, like, damn, you know, I wish they hadn't done that, or I wish that hadn't happened, or, you know, I wish that person were different, or, you know, this kind of reactivity that I experience is like, leads me to a sense of right and wrong and how things should be and how to change, you know, make this. And so the practice for me is to continuously notice that reactivity and see what happens to it. That oftentimes it clarifies only to come back again and then, like, you know, being with it again and seeing what, because and so that's where I struggle. I mean, it's because of how that hooks me. But anyway, so without my reactivity, I guess what you're pointing to is as the reactivity wears down, then there's a clarity that can open up to seeing something different than what you initially saw.
Well, and it is through the reactivity that the light comes in.
Yeah.
Right? Because we tend to think, I'm in a calm place. That's a better place than the reactive place. And we try to want more of one and the other. And I think this teaching is one, as Melissa said, it does not end. Life is like this. The Buddha was reactive. The Buddha engaged with Mara throughout his whole life. It's not like he was done with delusion. Oh yeah, I had that great conversation under the Bo tree and I'm cool. You know, so it's constant and it's so easy. And I think as we practice more, to think when the reactivity comes up, oh, rats, I thought I was beyond that. But what I hear you talking about is noticing that reactivity. That is the energy of life. That is actually showing us what we have not yet seen. And that there is always something we haven't known. And one of the best definitions I know of equanimity is being awake to reactivity. Not to be in this, oh, I'm just cool, but whoa! And then, what is this? What is this? And Camden, I loved your visceral saying and demonstration of how it is in the body. How it's a, we can, I think many of us can really feel it that way. And then this possibility of that, so not beyond, we don't have to be reactive to our reactivity. And I think that's what you're pointing to. That is the great freedom. Not to be in a place where we're so clear we never see it, although clarity does come. as we stay with the reactivity, we don't even have to do anything, but of itself, if we give it just a little bit of space, or maybe a lot of space, then it flames up, where does it go? We don't know where it goes, but we're a little bit, we're reborn, right? That reactivity teaches us, gives us its gift. So not a problem. This is the great freedom of Zen. It's a wonderful thing and a difficult thing.
And there's a little piece here. I always keep coming back. I don't know if it's true for the rest of you, but I have these core stories of interactions that I've had with people that still kind of haunt me because they're so puzzling, you know, about who I am, who the other person is, right? It goes on. And I've told this story a number of times because it's really one of my core koans. I'll disguise everything about this that I can so no one will ever guess who this person was. But there was a person who was taking a retreat with me, and he and his son were at the retreat together. And he was just the most reactive person I've ever met in my life. I mean, and I've met a lot of reactive people, including myself, but it was like, oh my God, everything was wrong, everything was terrible. And there was one point in the retreat where we were talking about this very thing, and he said, I have been practicing for 30 years, and I am no longer reactive. Talk about not being a child of illusion. He really believed this. And I didn't understand how deeply rooted he was in this belief that he had transcended reactivity through his meditation practice. So I tried to get him to react because I was reactive to him saying that he's not reactive. It was like one of these horrible moments. And then a few days later, he twisted his ankle and, you know, then like raging about the stairs and the, you know, the bad medical equipment at this particular retreat center. And he and his son decided to leave early for a number of reasons. And as they were leaving, he was saying to me, this has been a wonderful class or wonderful retreat. And it really, geez. And it was hard for me to believe that he had shifted his view like that. But he said, but this place, it's just the worst retreat center. It's horrible. And his son put his hand on his father's cheek and said, Daddy, you love to complain so much. And, and I said, wow, you do. And he said, I do. It's not just the spaciousness, but what I saw in that moment, that kid was a teacher for me. There's some kind of affection for being human, right? We are all reactive. We're all animals. How can we not be reactive? You know, if we weren't reactive, we'd be in deep shit. We would have all kinds of trouble. So being reactive is really healthy, human. But we hate it. I hate my reactivity. I don't want to be reactive. I want to be serene, calm, Zen master, just floating through the world. Well, just give me 10 seconds, it's over. Right? That oppositional thing. I don't want this. But this affection, this touch on the cheek, the loving being human. You know, I think that's what I hear in the child part of the child evolution. You know, think of that boy.
Avoid being a child of illusion. Like, this is it. This is the entry place. Jen, you were going to say something.
We have such a great capacity for simulation, and I have so many more simulated conversations with my little puppet versions of and sometimes they do or say something that reveals their simulated version of me, and I get offended. The world's more complex than your simulation. And sometimes I get surprised, pleasantly surprised, or disappointed, and think, yeah, the world's more complex than my simulation, too. And I'm so glad, because that world is so small, that my little simulated world, and I'm so glad the world is bigger than that.
I was thinking about a million things, of course, and when I first started coming here, it was such a new thing for me to be in a space like this with you and be able to talk and listen and sit. And I, whether it was Dokusan or Dharma talk, I would leave here and I would just be like, what now? Like I'm going home now. I have three dogs and three kids and, you know, not thinking these words at all, but and I used to really get frustrated, I still probably do, but with integration, and I heard recently one of us say, you know, speak of integration and stuff like that. And when I think of this, when I first read this line, the slogan, I thought of the days where I was like obsessed with illusion and delusion years ago. I was always wanting to understand the difference, always looking up the word history, and illusion is, from what I remember, if you're deluded, you can't see what you can't see. And if you are in an illusion, you can kind of tell that you're in it. You can kind of half see it and you know that you're in it. And when I read this, I thought, oh, this is about integration. In a way. It's like, and it's what everyone's already said too. It's what, you know, that you come away from this and you have in your head ideas, everything's on Zen or anything like that, but then your life hits you and the reactivity starts. Everything we've already said, you know, but it's this thing of like, it's like a weird permission or a secret gateway or trapdoor. Secret, like safe, not the kind that you fall into water that's too deep, you know. And like that you can sort of see it and not know. And that's okay. And you don't want to go one way or the other, kind of. You don't want to be, I meditated, and I'm all meditated up. Or, I, like you said, I can't do this. I don't know what this is. Why do I keep going here? Or whatever. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Thanks, Joanne. I wanted to say two brief things, and then Dave and Melissa will give a better answer. But... To your wonderful point. But one thing I wanted to say was I really find that distinction that you brought up, delusion and illusion, interesting and helpful. And then the scholar in me wants to say that of course what we're reading is a translation from Tibetan, which and then these, you know, some of these were translated from Sanskrit into Tibetan. So because sometimes we get very hung up on words that are in fact a translator's choice. Like, several times I've heard the same conversation about atonement, in God of atonement. Well, and atonement is like atonement. But maybe not in the Japanese or the Chinese or your Sanskrit, however far you go. I don't know how far back that God goes, you know, but it may have nothing to do with. You know, it's kind of cool that our English translation, we can play with atonement at one minute, but that may have nothing to do with the God of atonement. It may just be an artifact of a translator's choice. Having said that, though, I still think you're onto something. You know, but I just feel like I want to put that little warning out there, because we're so often dealing in Boundless Ways and with translated texts.
Mm-hmm. But I also want to say, not better than what Alan said. That's just some illusion that he's carrying in the inner Melissa. I found it really helpful that
the distinction that you made. I'd never heard it before. And I think it's very connected to what I was saying about reactivity. You know, that it's one thing to be reactive. It's another thing to feel and study reactivity, right? And really get to know it as our life. This is a course we're taking, is, you know, whatever, right? So illusion is, so it's really great to know, to have that little glimpse of oh, I'm in illusion, but not be able to stop it. Mm. You know, that's one of my favorite teachings is from Groundhog Day, that there's if people know that movie, there's a certain point where the hero knows what's going on. And so he's gone from delusion to illusion in what you're saying. And it doesn't make everything disappear. It doesn't free him, you know, from the repetitive nature of his days. But it gives him, it gives him space. Mm. It gives him space again, right? The space is what allows us to really be able to, we have freedom. Right, and freedom is not free from; it's free in. Right, we're free in the midst of illusion. So important, free in the midst of reactivity, of sadness, of fear, of aloneness, whatever it is that's plaguing us. Right, smack in the middle of it. Oh, this is what that is. Oh, you really do like to get lost in your delusions, don't you?
So let's continue the exploration. Mm-hmm.